Welcome to the Everyday Peacemaking Podcast. I'm Oshita Moore.
And I'm Jer Swigert. Join us as we grow our imaginations for joining God and others in mending divides.
Fear runs deep, spreading like a virus. Hate is cheap. From afar it costs you nothing. Sister, take my hand. Brother, we will stand. Open up.
Hey, friends, welcome back to the podcast. Oshita, good to be with you, my friend. And
yeah, good to be with you.
Yes, those of you who are listening in, you know, one of our convictions here at Global Immersion is that peacemaking is not for the professional humanitarians, pastors, politicians. It's for all of us. This isn't an add-on to our faith. It's the essence of it. It's how we show up on the planet. And we also say that the rubber meets the road of all of our peacemaking practice within our wingspan, where we are at a particular moment. And so as you're listening, maybe you're on a commute, maybe you're on a walk, and maybe you're cooking some food, whatever it is, maybe look around right now and understand that this is the place of your peacemaking practice. And the role of this podcast is to just slow drip some consciousness, some imagination, some inspiration, some practical insight in terms of how we can make peace right where we are. And today we continue a conversation around the power of the table. And we said in a previous episode that the table is the most important piece of furniture in the work of everyday peacemaking. Many of us have them. And if not, they're set in community spaces all around our cities. And so we're really pressing in on this theme because we think that this is one of the tools that we all have access to. And it's really powerful, the kind of reparative work that can happen when we sit around set or invited to tables. And so, Oshita, this is something that you and I have been talking about for years. And I know that we both have lots of stories to share out of the ways in which we use our table. I know you've got one in particular this morning. So bring us in. Bring us into how you're thinking about the table, and then bring us into a story here.
Right. Well, I am actually going to tell the story of two tables that have been important fixtures of peacemaking for me, because I am, you know, I'm a pastor, so I'm highly mindful of the season we're in. We're in Lent, and there are so many conversations about food. There's so many conversations about the table right now. And so I was just thinking, after you shared last time in our conversation about the table, the space that was created where people who are on opposite sides of this battle, of this like great conflict, made room and space for each other through food and through music. I was thinking about when the table was important for me and kind of how the table showed up in a way that reframed how I practiced peacemaking. So you and I right now, we are working on the Deep South Immersion for our Journey of Hope cohort. And I'm so excited about it. It's going to be such a sweet time with the cohort that we have. And it has me thinking about one of the trips that I led down south a few years ago, where I did everything wrong. My expectations as a peacemaker and equipping the peacemakers that were entrusted to me were really unrealistic and was actually a little bit harmful, because I understood the gravity of what we were learning, the importance of being anti-racist in a white supremacist society. And most of my cohort members that I was entrusted to lead were white. And I had all these expectations for them of like understanding these issues and understanding policies and history and owning their privilege and all these things, right? And I was taught to be an anti-racist teacher with this kind of posture that's just like, I don't really care if this is uncomfortable for you. And I don't really care if this brings up trauma for you. Like, your feelings don't really matter that much. Like, your actions matter. Your work matters. How you show up. Your voice matters. Really, it was not a deeply empathic or loving posture. But it felt like I was taught that because I'm a woman of color in these mostly white spaces. And I was taught like, that's how I create healthy boundaries with the white people that I will teach. So that was my posture with this group. And I could feel this distance between them and myself in the weeks leading up to the trip, because I was with them for several months, teaching them these issues of race and justice and in the intersection of anti-racism and peacemaking. But I did not personally feel like I was doing a great job of being a peacemaker because I had this deep distance from them. So when we get on the actual trip, I had planned the trip where it was like nonstop fear. It was nonstop. It was like we were going to a museum, or we were going to a memorial, or we were going to a sacred place. We were learning and talking and lamenting. And then we were getting on a bus and driving to two vans and driving, then setting up camp, camping, and then doing it all over again. And this was like a 7-day trip. And halfway through the trip, I was exhausted. And like the violence of what I was seeing was getting on the inside of me. And it was just kind of reinforcing that distance from my group. By the grace of God, there was a torrential rainstorm. And after we were leaving one of our museums, and I was in the van with my cohort leader, who was a white man. And I was like, I don't think we should set up camp in this rainstorm. Like, we're already going to get there and it's going to be dark and it's going to be a rainstorm. What do we do? And like, honestly, in the back of my mind, I was also thinking like, I didn't have my hair in braids at that point. And so I was like, my hair is going to get wet. I don't have a blow dryer, like all these things. I was like, this, I'm going to be my most uncomfortable. And then that's just going to deepen that distance where I just can't feel like I'm like my full self with them. So I was like, what should we do? And he's like, I think we have budget. Maybe let's like get a hotel. Let's get some hotel rooms. And I was like, what if we got like an Airbnb? Like, what if I found an Airbnb on the way that had enough room and space? And I made dinner for the group. Because there was a part of me that was like recognizing that there was this distance. And I was trying to figure out, how do I bridge that gap? How do I connect with them? And I love to cook. And so I was like, what if? And he was like, okay, well, if you can find one within this budget, he gave me a dollar amount. So I just went to work on my phone and found this beautiful A-frame cabin. I've never seen anything that beautiful at that cost ever again on Airbnb. And it was like just the right amount of space for us. And I messaged the owner and I was like, hi, we're a group or about 10, 12 people. Here's why we're on the road. And he was like, I know, because his thing said no parties. I was like, I know you said no parties. We're not a party. He was so gracious. And so we got there and I could visibly sense the relief in the group of like, oh, we don't have to do the hard thing on top of the hard thing again. Like I could sense that. And as I was looking at them, I was like, oh, they're entering into a space of like comfort and being able to be cared and warm and they're resting. And then some of them wanted to go out to drive to Selma to walk across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. Some of us stayed. Some went to the grocery store for me. And I just put on spirituals, Negro spirituals, and I just cooked gumbo with this recipe that I learned from a white woman when we lived in New England. It has tomatoes in it, which if you talk to anybody from New Orleans or from Louisiana, you don't put tomatoes in a gumbo. And I was really skeptical, but she put it in and it was delicious. And so I made that particular recipe because it was my intentional practice of creating a dish that was rooted in a culture, but had like influence from a white peacemaker. I intentionally made that dish. I had to make 2 or 3 different versions of it, like a vegetarian one without shrimp, and then one with shrimp. And it was amazing because everybody came in from all their various places. Some people went and took showers or took a nap while I cooked. And some people went to Edmund Pettus and then they came in and they had stories about that. And some people just like laid by the fire and was like on their phones or reading. And I was just able to cook for them and invite them to the table. And what I noticed was that during that time, none of us recapped the trip. Like none of us like shared like deep heart stories about like how the trip is going. But all of us felt a little bit more human, a little bit more connected, a little bit more cared for. And it just reminded me that we're like, radical hospitality is the backbone of peacemaking for me. Like crafting a space where people feel welcomed in and cared for is the most disarming thing I can do. Because that very next day was an important day in me integrating belovedness into my anti-racism peacemaking, which changed everything for me. And I really believe, because for that whole trip, we had kind of just stopped at fast food restaurants and been on our own. We were eating sandwiches out the back of the van. Like We were just kind of eating off in separate spaces, but the bringing of all of us together just for the simple purpose of being together and having a meal together and being cared for deepened my love for them and made me want to care for them and care about them. And the violence that was inside of me was disarmed. Mm. And then, so as I was thinking about that, I was also thinking about the season that we're coming into, which is we're in Lent, but we're going to be coming into Holy Week, where there is a particular invitation to come to the table and have a meal together and talk about our vulnerabilities and make room for caring for each other. It's called Maundy Thursday. And as I was thinking about this experience on that trip, I was thinking that like, that was an important moment in Jesus's equipping of his disciples to be peacemakers leading up to one of the most violent acts that they could have ever experienced, watching Jesus be crucified, of like this, as they were going on this good work of bringing, of being disciples, of bringing the kingdom of God to bear alongside Jesus, Jesus stopped and made space for them to be fed and cared for. And he washed their feet. He made space for them to feel human and tended to, and invited them to the table. And he disarmed them so that they can go about the work of being disarmed. So yeah, so those, that's kind of how I am interacting with this idea of the table, and so incredibly grateful for this really practical way of showing up as a peacemaker.
Well, it's just such an unbelievable story, especially because the story that you share, I think, illustrates for us that in holding and hosting the table, we ourselves are transformed. We ourselves are disarmed. And I think so often in work of peacemaking, our focus of the restorative work tends to be out there with those people. And in fact, the very practice of the table disarmed you, transformed you, deepened your compassion, and expanded the reach of your empathy. Yeah. It's a remarkable story for all of us. There's a couple of things that pop for me that I'd love to just interact with you on a little bit more. One, I'm struck by pace and the table as a place to slow down. Now, in this case, people are in the midst of an intense, immersive experience that's programmatically designed for them in our everyday lives. I think many of us are just, the realities have us gasping for air at times. Life feels intense, busy, fast. Yeah. And I hear in you this notion of the table is a place to reset our pace a little bit. It's a sacred pause. And I wonder how many of us think about the table as daily opportunities for the sacred pause. So I'd love to hear you reflect on that a little bit more. Secondly, the way that you shared that story leaves me with the sense of you setting a table as a space to hold people. I just got this picture of like table as refuge, a place where empathy can grow, a place of vulnerability. Yeah, a place where I can let my hair down, not just as a good idea, but as something that I actually need consistently in my everyday. And so table as refuge is something that I hear there. And then the last thing is very practical. You selected a recipe that in your life has a proven track record for fueling the kind of restorative, healing, relationship developing work that's possible around the table. And so I think there's like a mindset and there's a culture that you're intentional about in the way that you set and host a table. And it even comes down to the kind of recipe that you create, because you know that as people are eating this particular dish, something happens. And I'm just wondering if you could help us, even as folks, whether we know how to cook or not, how do we go about identifying, like, what's the go-to recipe? Some would call it comfort food, right? Like, what's our go-to recipe that helps us disarm, relax into a more healthy pace, and maybe see ourselves and one another more clearly?
Yeah, I want to first talk about the pace, because I deeply believe that peacemaking begins in me. Like, if I don't do the work to be a grounded peacemaker within myself and between God, then when I practice peacemaking out in the world, there are expectations, there's ego, there's potential for harm that causes more problems than it helps bind up the brokenness that I want to be a part of. So for me, like, it's so important to do that work here. So I think that the pace thing really began with me. Like, I realized that I was going at a pace with this group that didn't feel good in my body, and that I was losing my capacity for empathy and care. And I was also getting kind of self-righteous. And that pause of like, you know what? We don't have to do things the way we've always done on this trip. Like, we're going to spend a little money and get an Airbnb instead of camping and, like, you know, toughing it out. That change of pace and that change of, like, our expectations was important for me to speak up, because I needed that for myself. And I think that oftentimes as a peacemaker, I can get so wrapped up in tending to other people or thinking about, like, what do other people need, that I forget that I am a peacemaker too. It's kind of like this thing as a parent where, like, when I plan our meal plans for my family, I'm thinking about, like, what everybody in the house wants for dinner. But sometimes I don't even make my favorite things. Like, I don't make it because I don't think anybody else is going to eat it. And so I just don't make it because it's like the most efficient thing to do is to make something that everybody will eat. But, like, I'm part of the family too. Like, you know, we are part of the peacemaking too. So, like, what feels good and right? And so that slowing down that pace was important for me, and a model to them, these white allies who I feel like it's so important for them to own their humanity and take care of themselves, practice good soul and self-care, which is not a message that they get often. I felt like that was important for them to have that space too.
Yeah, I like, it's so practical for all of us, right? Like, few of us lead trips. All of us are caught in a pace of life and the demands. And again, this notion that anticipating everybody else's needs, we can actually become frenetic and paced and overly driven and all these things to meet all that. But, like, in what you're inviting us into is, like, pay attention to what's happening, the discernment and the perception that's happening inside of your body, and trust it a little bit.
Yes.
You know, that's really helpful for us.
Yeah. Well, yes, because, yeah, we are part of the peacemaking, you know, and I might even go so far as to say we were entrusted to be the peacemakers that space needs. And so if we don't pay attention to ourselves and how we are showing up, then we are shortchanging the capacity for a restoration. But again, that's like a big trip kind of situation. What I love is, like, how you call the table, our tables in our home, a place for that sacred pause. Because I have teenagers who eat at different times of the day or now have their own money, and so they'll DoorDash themselves something. And I have noticed that there are times where I feel like, where are my people in the world? You know, like, when they were little, it was easier to bring everybody to the table. But now, like, they all have their different lives. And so we've had to reclaim the table as a space for coming back together. And also the lowering of the expectations of what needs to happen at that table. Like, my kids kind of, when we first started doing Sunday dinner more often as teens, they were like, oh, what's this table? Like, what are we having dinner for? Like, are we scheduling? Is something going on in the family? Like, why are we getting together? They were all like, and we're like, no, we just like you. Just, like, sit down and have a meal with us. And so I think also too, we, part of our practice of the table is to have table for the sake of table, not necessarily to diffuse or disarm some sort of conflict.
Which is so on point here for our conversations, because we're saying we actually have to break agreement with our desire for the cataclysmic, big, huge moments and the sensational and all the thing. No, we're actually microdosing repair as we, as you said, do the table together.
One of my favorite times at the table with my family, honestly, Jer, was it was like a silent dinner, just because we were all kind of tapped out and we didn't have a whole lot to offer each other. And so I was like, listen, bring your phones, put your AirPods in, and just, like, be on TikTok. And when you find something that you want the rest of the group to see, just wave and show us. But, like, it's okay. As long as we are together in the same space, having the same meal, it's okay. And I just sensed, you know, in spiritual direction, we sometimes say we let the silence do the heavy lifting. And I just sensed that just the space of, like, being together, not necessarily having to talk something out or have an icebreaker or whatever, but just being together, we remembered that we are family and we remembered ourselves as family members. And I think that is an important practical practice of peacemaking.
Yeah, spot on, which is, you know, one of my favorite parts of Maundy Thursday. And then, of course, the tradition of the Eucharist or the Lord's table that emerges out of that for us in the Christian tradition, this notion that around the table and specifically through a specific recipe or through specific elements, we're remembered together. We remember yes. our oneness, and it creates the opportunity in the consuming of the food as we're sharing it with each other. It creates the opportunity to look at each other and maybe begin to wonder, is there any interruption in our relationships? Is there anything that we need to deal with one another in order to reinforce our oneness?
Yes, yes. That's what the table is for, to remember that we belong to each other. So that makes me kind of want to interact with your last thought about like a recipe that I chose. So my spiritual mother used to say the best ingredient in any recipe she has is love. And I'm like, that's such an old Black woman thing to say. But she would always say that. I'd be like, what did she put in this? And she like, this, and love. Like, that's always how she would react and respond. And as I was cooking that gumbo, like, I literally was thinking, Lord, I want to infuse love in this dish. Let them feel loved. Like, I literally was praying that because I was trying to get over that. I don't want to call it hate, but that indifference that was bubbling up in me towards that group. And so I think, like, in order for us to create space for people to be loved and to experience love in our dishes, it has to be something we love to cook or we love to serve. I went to dinner with another couple at their house, and the husband left to go to this pizza parlor that they love to get this deep dish. And she's like, I only get this deep dish when we have people over. It is my absolute favorite, and we only order it when we host. And I was like, that's the stuff. That is infusing a dish with love, even if he didn't make it. It's like, I only have this when I have people. Or like, I just made 3 pots of gumbo for a book club that I was with. And I was like, I only make this recipe this big, like with this level of intention. Because it was like, I let it slow cook. I let it sit in the fridge. Then I add it. Like, it was like this whole process. I was like, I only go through this whole process with this dish. Or I only, like, at Thanksgiving, I only like think about it, this meal at Thanksgiving, like this way, because I love these people. And so I think whatever dish feels like that for you, and it can just be like, I make the best omelet. I only add Boursin and Lay's potato chips. If anybody watches The Bear, that makes sense to you. When I make this omelet for this person, I think that is how you discern what to make at the table to help everyone remember that they belong to each other, because you created something, hopefully, that you can do from memory because you love it so much. So don't overthink it. Look, this Maundy Thursday, I'm making red beans and rice because that's the thing that I can go to and it's easy and it's always good and it can feed a lot of people. And I love making it. So
and I
think that's an important thing.
Yeah. And it's such an international dish, you know, obviously in this moment in time where I'm thinking about our siblings in Gaza that physically don't have tables nor access to food as so many in our world do. And also recognizing that in all over the planet, there are people who red beans and rice or beans and rice is it's a staple. It's not just for survival, but it's a comfort food that is offered along the way. And so I love, and even for Maundy Thursday, for that to be a moment of solidarity with our global family to eat red beans or rice. How do you prepare them?
Okay, I will tell you how I'll prepare my red beans and rice, but then I want to know, Jer, what is your like dish that you love to make, that you love to serve? It's super simple. My red beans, I soak them overnight, and then I do onion and peppers and celery, and so the Trinity, and garlic, and then sausage. And I just saute the sausage, and then I put the veggies in that and saute that all together. Then I put the beans, and then I let it cook slow, let it slow and go. And then I'm slowly like, every time I go to stir it, I add a little bit of Tony's so that it, like, the flavor deepens and becomes richer. And then if it's kind of still soupy, then I'll take the beans out and I'll mash them and then put them back in so that it's kind of like a nice, like, stewy consistency. And then I put it over beans. Mm-hmm. And sometimes if I have French bread, we'll do French bread. Or if I make peasant bread, sometimes I like to make peasant bread, I'll do that. Or if I really love you, I'll make honey cornbread.
Oh, which I have not had at your house, which is an indication of where I stand with you. One day, perhaps.
No, you've had my gumbo. You've had my long, slow gumbo.
Yeah, I've had the gumbo.
So that's like next level.
Right.
Okay, what do you serve?
Yeah, I don't make it, but I beg Jackie to make it. It's this lemongrass chicken and rice that's like a Thai dish. Mm-hmm. It's just a sensational meal, and it's so flavorful, and there's just plenty of it. And I find that when that's on the table, and we have guests around, there's a communal resonance with how delicious it is. But there's something about the flavors of that dish that, you know, like the lemongrass and the ginger, and it like it opens something up. And I just find that that also mirrors what's happening around the table. I'm excited about the meal. I probably bring some enthusiasm in it, but like I even think the ingredients itself are conducive for opening us up to one another. And then I think every good meal deserves to be topped off with a crisp or a cobbler. So that's our go-to when we're setting the table for guests in our home. The other thing that I would say, and this is interesting for those of us to consider, is some of us get overwhelmed by the thought of hosting a table and feeling the pressure for it to be perfect and all these things. And we've actually found that the more informal it is and the more accessible the food is, actually the more comfortable people tend to be. And mm-hmm. I think there's something there as well for us to consider as we're using our own tables for the restorative work, whether that's deepening existing relationships or creating the space for new ones to be formed, especially across difference. But it's also, you know, don't be pretentious in the way that you set the table, especially if there's some interruption in the relationship. Be accessible in the way that you think about that food. But here's the other thing that we think about a lot is it's one thing to walk into a home where the meal is prepared and rolled out, and here we go. It's another thing to enter into a space and the person who's making the meal hands you a knife and says, can you chop the peppers for me? You know, yeah. So it's like the table, the experience of the table, there's a collaboration, there's a journey, there's a currency of relationship, the tissue of relationship grows toward one another as we're both chopping onions in the kitchen together, you know? So even think about that in terms of how we use our kitchens, our homes that then move us toward the table as a place of refuge and disarming. And so
I would say, I would agree with you on that. I would maybe take it one step further, because actually for me as an introvert, I kind of crave that space in the kitchen just to be by myself. It can get overwhelming to have somebody come into the kitchen and me give them a task. So then I think about other aspects of the evening or the experience that they can. So like, hi, would you mind like would you pour the drink? So I always ask somebody to like come up with a cocktail or a mocktail to go with whatever I'm making. And I ask them to bring all that. And then I'm like, hey, would you put together your cocktail or your mocktail over here? And I always ask somebody to come with the icebreaker or come with a question. Or like I put the icebreakers on the table. I'm like, choose from these so that we have something, or like go set the table. I kind of, just for my own like neurodivergence, and I actually really like the kitchen space for myself. But so I just want to expand that too, of like, if that feels like, oh, I don't want to give somebody a knife, or I don't want to entrust this recipe to someone because they might do it wrong, just think of other aspects that feel less important to you. My therapist used to always tell me this, like, what are the things that you actually need to take over yourself? Because you can stay grounded and comfortable mm-hmm. in that space and then let everybody else do the other things. Mm-hmm. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah. I wanted to know, when you think about those spaces where people come together and have like a really good meal with each other and you send them off, how is the aftermath for you? Like when they're back in the world, do you feel like a responsibility or a deeper connection to them? Do you feel like, what is that sending out piece? Because I think as much as being at the table is an important part, the benediction and sending back into the world for us as hosts is an important part too. So do you have any thoughts as we close our conversation of the table around that benediction piece, or people who are at our table, our hopes for them when they're back in the world?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think sometimes for us, it's whether it was a hard conversation or a really super generative conversation. I think ending the time around the table with expressions of gratitude for one another, and probably less what they do or what we do or, you know, or anything else like that. And just mm-hmm. more like, what happened around this table that I'm grateful for? What do I see in you? The table is a shared experience. It's a moment. And hopefully there are several more moments that we're going to find ourselves around tables. Again, I don't want to overprogram anything. I want to be really open to whatever it is that happens in that space. I want to be intentional, but I want to be open. And I think part of it, I want people leaving my table with a deeper sense of belief in their own belovedness. I want them leaving my table with a deeper belief in the revolution that we get to be a part of. I want them leaving with an understanding that we see them, that they matter to me, they matter to us, and that we can't imagine walking into the future without doing it side by side with them. So I think that's some of the remembering. I think there's just ways in which we can express gratitude that's personal to each person that sits around the table.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, I think that as much as the planning of the recipe and the being at the table and then the good work that's done at the table, the benediction, like what is our hope? And I've experienced that of you, Jer, of like at the end of our time, when we've had meals together, you tend to do this beautiful kind of moment of gratitude and reflection. And it doesn't feel overprogrammed. It feels really natural. And so I think that is an important part of sending everyone out in the world. So we are going to be encouraging our listeners, our community, to go to the table, practice peacemaking at the table this Lenten season, specifically through Maundy Thursday. So we talked a little bit about that, and we want to encourage you to bring people together on March 28th, which is the Thursday before Easter. And if you are a person of faith, a faith-filled person for whom Jesus is your primary example of a peacemaker, we encourage you to read the account of when he invited his friends to a table and the Last Supper and washed their feet and shared with them particular elements. One of my favorite parts of the Maundy Thursday conversation is kind of our vulnerabilities and how can we care for each other. I always include that in a Maundy Thursday table because some of us don't like to wash each other's feet. That feels weird. But there, it can be a space where we can say, hi, how are you? What do you need? What feels like a way that I can show up for you? And so even if you invite somebody out, like we said in our first conversation, for coffee and a pastry on March 28th and ask them, how can I care for you? What do you need? And what is life like for you? That is a powerful practice of peacemaking. So we just invite you to join with us as we do that. On the 28th, there'll be more information about Holy Week because, Jer, as I understand, there's going to be a devotional that we have partnered with CCDA.
That's right.
Available.
Yeah. So we've worked with CCDA to create a Holy Week devotional that will be accessible very soon. And Oshita actually worked to craft some of the breath prayers. We've got authors from all over the world who are offering reflections for us, very accessible reflections throughout Holy Week. And so that's a very practical tool for peacemakers and freedom fighters here in the West to continue to cultivate our souls and our imaginations as peacemakers. But there's also a hyper-practical recipe that you're going to put in front of us, Oshita. Give us that.
Yes. So I described my red beans and rice recipe. So I will actually write it up and it will be available for you. But also, if you have my book, Shalom Sisters, it's in that book too. But I will be sharing my recipe and maybe even a picture of my table. I know that's helpful for some home cooks to see what it should look like. And the reason why I'm suggesting red beans and rice for those of us who want to cook and host a table this Maundy Thursday is just what you said earlier, Jer, is that every culture has a red beans and rice recipe. Red beans and rice is cost effective. It's accessible. It's simple. And also what I love about it is you can throw whatever seasonings you want into it. So I make it with a Cajun kind of flair because I use Tony's, but I've seen people use different seasonings and it still tastes delicious, different proteins, and it still tastes delicious. So I will be sharing a red beans and rice recipe.
There you have it, friends. The table's not static. It's a powerful tool in the work of everyday peacemaking. It's an opportunity to bring folks together who maybe don't see eye to eye. It's the opportunity to bring existing relationships and to see one another more deeply, to immerse into one another's stories and to learn how we can contend for and with one another in our own communities. As you think about your tables, be purposeful. Throw a recipe that opens people up and for the formation of good relationships. We believe that the table is the most important piece of furniture in the work of peacemaking. Use it. Use it with us this Maundy Thursday. We can't wait to hear the stories. Tearing down walls. Hey friends, you heard us allude to this in the episode, but there's a devotional resource that we've partnered with CCDA in creating. It features authors from all over the world who are reflecting on the beauty and the mystery of Holy Week. It's accessible very shortly wherever you get resources connected to Global Immersion, including globalimmerse.org and in our show notes. Also, as the pain continues to mount in Gaza, we're committed to the ongoing work of growing a pro-human understanding and engagement in this crisis. One of the ways that we're doing that right now is helping us move beyond information to actually putting our bodies in the line through solidarity. The initiative is called the Gaza Ceasefire Pilgrimages. It's a global movement. You can find a link to it in our show notes. And there's walks being planned throughout the Lent season all over the country and even the world. We invite you to go to the website to find a walk that's likely happening in your space and get involved in this. If you live in the Spokane, Washington area or the Twin Cities area in particular, there's ways that you can actually engage with the Global Immersion team specifically. We hope to see you on one of these pilgrimages as we walk in solidarity with those who are suffering. We're walking toward an end to this violence. The Everyday Peacemaking Podcast is a production of Global Immersion and is made possible by our Embers community of monthly donors.
Sincere thanks to The Brilliance for use of their song, Turning Over Tables. Learn more about the work of Global Immersion, forming everyday peacemakers and reconciling leaders to mend divides at globalimmerse.org.